I'm your host, Leon Bubas, with Rabbi Shimon Felix and Ben Waxman, and welcome to another edition of The Shmooze. We have two topics tonight. Both are really hot in Israel, controversial. One of which is the conviction of Elor Azariah, a soldier accused of and convicted of manslaughter in the shooting death of a terrorist who tried to kill one of his buddies in his army unit while they were in patrol. And that's the first topic that we'll discuss tonight. And Ben, I know you wrote an article for the Israel Times, I believe, that spoke out against granting blanket amnesty to Elor Azariah. Can you discuss your article?
I'm not going to start. I don't want to rehash the facts of what happened there.
Okay.
We'll just say the man was convicted of killing a prisoner who was no longer a threat to anybody at the point when he shot him. I'm just taking that as a simple starting off point. Now, when I was in the Army, I'll start off with a little story. I saw things that shouldn't have happened, where soldiers used excess force, too much force, without any shadow of a doubt. It wasn't according to the rules. It wasn't according to the Geneva Convention. It wasn't according to this. It wasn't according to that. The Army backed us up, saying that it was done at a time and in instances when there were disturbances going on. You can't dot every I and cross every T when rocks are being thrown at you, when bottle bombs are being thrown at you, when scores of people are trying to attack you. The Army allows soldiers a great deal of leeway in what they do. It really, really does. Even with all the rules, the Army really allows people, it understands that things happen. But at some point, there's a limit. When someone has been completely and absolutely neutralized, at that point, you have to say, stop. You either give him first aid, whatever the, if need be, or you imprison him, but you don't shoot him at that point. Now, why is this so important to me? Because once these rules start being broken and people look the other way, it won't stop there. At some point after killing a neutralized terrorist, then a civilian Arab will be killed. People will take this violence back with them when they go home. They'll take it with them to their families. They'll take it with them to their friends. They'll get into bar fights and just kill someone at the drop of the hat. Violence never stops where you think it's going to stop. It always keeps going and going and going. And until it blows up in your face, literally, in ways you never even imagined. We have to have these rules which say, ad kan, until this point and no further. Elor Azariah went too far. That prisoner was no threat to anybody by the court's account, by the testimony. He was bleeding to death. He was immobilized. If he could move his hand a little bit like that, okay. Even after people die, they can still move their arms or a limb here or there. He wasn't going to do anything. He had no right to kill that person. And when he broke that rule, he stopped being a soldier and he became a murderer. So for that reason, no pardon can be given, at least not at this time. In a few years, if good behavior and we can think about it in the future, but at this point in time, no pardon.
I have to agree with just about everything Ben said. And even let me begin by amplifying something. We also had the news yesterday, the shooting in Fort Lauderdale at the airport. So putting aside the insanity of the American gun law situation, which is, it's really just a three-ring circus over there. But this fellow apparently served in Iraq, had gotten himself committed, had tried to get treatment, had told people, including the FBI, that he was hearing voices telling him to join terror organizations, and he wasn't taken care of. Now that, you know, the fashlas, the mistakes that were made by the system there bespeak a country in free fall. And our topic is not the end of the American empire, but parenthetically, let me say, wow, the end of the American empire. But the point I do want to make, and I thought about this when Ben, because of something Ben said, you know, Israel is a great candidate for a lot more post-traumatic stress syndrome than we see. It exists, of course, and a lot of our guys do have problems after the various wars or different kinds of operations that Tzahal does. It's not as if we're beyond that or we're above that. It happens. But taken as a whole, Israeli soldiers do pretty well in the aftermath of, as you said, Ben, the often really horrible things that they are forced to see and to do. And I think one of the reasons is a sense of rightness in what we're doing, the exact opposite of what Vietnam was all about. Like, what the hell are we doing here? What is this insane, surreal experience about? Pointless death, meaningless killing. Whereas here, there's a very high level of idealism, of understanding that we're doing it because we have to do it and it's right to do it. And I think, you know, I'm not a psychologist, but I do think that helps people get past the really horrible things that they witness and that they take part in. And I absolutely agree with what you said, that if we move away from a legitimate sense of broadly we're doing the right thing, broadly we're behaving as well, just about as well as we can, so then I really agree with you that all kinds of chickens can come home to roost, and we'll be seeing a very different kind of response on the part of the Israeli public. And it is the public. Everyone goes more or less to the army, except for the groups that we know don't go. And losing that sense, again, you know, the most moral army in the world, we really try very hard and we do better than most. I'm confident in saying that. And what happened with Elor Azariah, if unpunished, really, really opens the door to losing that. Having said that, still, you know, these guys, honestly, I heard, and I don't hear the news 24/7, ministers and security officials saying things like a terrorist should not leave the area alive. And if somebody comes to kill us, he cannot leave alive. He's got to be killed. And rabbis say it, and teachers say it, and security people say it, and ministers and Knesset members say it. And so an average kind of kid from Ramallah, who is not sophisticated and not very clever and probably leaning, I think we know, leaning to the right as it is, the fault is not all with him. And I really do have a sense that, once again, this is the Shin Gimel. This is the guard at the gate rather than the higher-ups and the officers who, on a meta level, what I just said, they created, less in the army, but more, I think, among the politicians, a situation where an average kid might think, you know, I really should kill this guy. But also, I think, a sense of nervousness and anger that has legitimacy. I also wanted to say, and also a sense that on the micro level where the incident was taking place, there seems to have not been the order that you would expect there to be, the seder that you would expect there to be. The guy was just laying there. Nobody seemed to be taking care of it one way or the other. So on the micro level, and as well as on the meta level of a kind of sense that these guys shouldn't walk out of it alive, I see him as, yes, a kind of a victim. Doesn't mean he's innocent. Doesn't mean he should not go to jail. But I think the higher-ups, once again, get a free pass, the politicians, for setting a kind of a stage where a dumb kid could think that this is okay, will not only get away with it, but do it again tomorrow. That needs to be addressed. I don't know if it legally changes much for him, but I think socially and culturally, it does need to be addressed.
I just wanted to say that with regard to politicians, I have to point out, going back to the fact that Netanyahu, after Benjamin Netanyahu, our prime minister, I think it was the very day or perhaps the next day, the first thing he did, public thing, was to phone the parents of Elor Azariah and commiserate with them. After presumably he had seen the video like everyone else, and a few hours after the sentencing, the first thing he did, and he had plenty of time to think about it, was to say he should be pardoned. And I don't know, the cynic in me says, you know, that he saw that or heard that his political instincts, that this Elor Azariah has tremendous support. I mean, the kid has a lot of support in the country. A lot of people back him. A lot of people support him, which I think is more frightening than in some ways than the incident himself. And you here have the prime minister of the country basically undercutting the ministry, the then minister of defense, who condemned it. undercutting the Ramatkao, the chief of staff. And to me, in addition, like Ben said, you know, you never know when this is going to stop. When you legitimize this action, you basically legitimize in the future all sorts of actions. But for the highest official in the land to do those two things, I think was very telling. And I think Netanyahu is a very intelligent person, despite all his failings. And I don't think that this was, I mean, if it was, let's put it this way, as they say in the language of yeshivas, minan afshach. If he really believed it, then it's not good that this was the prime minister of the country. And if he didn't believe it, which I'm more inclined to believe, then it bespoke a cynical attitude towards politics, which is very harmful. I don't know if anyone wants to add to that or comment on my maybe perceived political comments, but they're really not. It doesn't matter who of any politician of any stripe who would have said the same thing. I think I would have had the same reaction.
Well, I was very disappointed by many politicians, not just Netanyahu. Mm-hmm. The fact that the defense minister felt the need to speak, not just to say something bland, a statement like I saw the video and I am ordering a full investigation into the incident and it will be treated according to the rules of the army and the Israeli law. He went and actually condemned the soldier before the investigation had even started formally. That was, he should have kept his mouth shut. A lot of other politicians, I could start naming names, but there's no need to because there were a great number of politicians from the left and from the right using this as a platform for their own purposes. Like you said, Netanyahu did, other politicians did. The incident became much larger than what it was or what it needed to be, and that only served to hurt the country and the army. I was just looking just now at the names of the four soldiers who were killed today, Zichronom Libracha, of the blessed memory, and two of them are from, one was from Gush Etzion, one's from Ma'ale Adumim, one is from Haifa, and one is from Givatayim. Two soldiers from the territories, if you want, Yehuda Visharon, two soldiers from inside the Green Line, three women, one man, one is religious. I don't know about the others, maybe secular soldiers, everyone working. It's very symbolic that these four soldiers are from all different parts of the country, men, women, religious, non-religious, everyone working together for the army. And here were politicians from every stripe, especially from the right, but also really ripping the army apart. And it's just a horrible, horrible thing what many politicians did. And they really, really, a lot of them really need to be ashamed of themselves. Today, what happened today with the death of those four young people just showed to me just what a horrible thing that some of these people did.
Yeah, I totally agree. I really do think that it's showing a kind of political culture in free fall. Both on the right, I mean, Bibi, I think, will, again, as he always does, you know, move right to sort of rally his base. He did it now again, showing up very quickly at the Tayelet, at the site of the attack today, the truck attack today. And it's what he does, and it works. But the left was just as bad, you know, using this poor soldier, because in this way, he is a poor soldier. You know, because he's become, I think Shelly Achimovich said, his shoulders are way too narrow to carry the burden of this argument. Because it's really an argument about the settlements and about the West Bank and about the two-state solution and the occupation and the Arabs. It's an argument about the whole damn thing. And this kid, whether he acted out of maliciousness, stupidity, nervousness, a combination of all three, it probably is a combination of all three. He certainly doesn't need to become the poster boy of everyone's political aspirations for what should happen between us and the Palestinians. And I think it really is a tu'udat aniyut. It's a real a mark of the impoverished culture, political culture that we've entered into, which, by the way, we share with most of the Western world. The Western world seems to be in this kind of free fall in terms of leadership and political culture, where everyone is just scrambling to get more extreme than the next guy, to shore up his base, to play to his extreme, the extremes of his party, because they're the ones who get out and make the noise. And it's awful. And Bibi, I think, you know, it really is. I don't necessarily want to segue into the next thing, but it does seem to me that Bibi now is probably going to be up against a real challenge. Whether it'll beat him or he'll beat it, who knows? But it looks like he's up against a real challenge now in terms of his corruption investigation. And someone said to me, you know, he's just, did he order this terror attack? It's a horrible thing to say, and they didn't mean it in any way. But it always seems to be that when, and not just with Bibi, by the way, Olmert did it moving left. I'll bring peace, but if you put me in jail, how can I bring peace? So everybody does it. The left does it. The right does it. And Bibi hopefully will not be able to use today's terror attack to make us all forget about the champagne and the cigars and Haaretz and everything and the Yediot and everything else. But yes, it's horrible the way the politicians are using the army as a political football. This poor soldier, this awful soldier, this horrible, you know, whatever he is. But again, I think he is poor in this. From this way of looking at it, as a kind of political football to just push their agendas. It's horrible.
Okay. I think that we had a sort of more or less, a meeting of the minds on that one, but it's certainly an issue that I think, right, Felix mentioned and Ben mentioned that it's much beyond this particular soldier. I think everyone is in agreement that it evokes and arouses a lot of emotions and a lot of issues which go beyond Elor Azaria, whatever his fate will be. We're going to get to the scandals. They really hit with full force before Shabbat and today. And really, I could go on about previous. Let me just talk about the two main investigations that are going on against Netanyahu and really not get into the past, because we could spend a lot of time on the past. The two main allegations are, which are being now investigated, are one that, which they call Parshat 1000 for some reason, that over a long period of time, in one case perhaps 7 years, he received from Aaron Milchan, who's a billionaire Israeli businessman with a very interesting past, who's worth apparently about $5.6 billion if you're counting, he received hundreds of thousands of shekels of very expensive cigars by Shaliach, you know, every week or every month or every day, I don't know, and pink champagne for the first lady, perhaps. And there was, I think, also gifts from Ron Lauder, who was perhaps less generous, or perhaps it wasn't quite as forthright in his testimony as what he gave and what he did not give. And that's the first topic, I guess, the first hakira. And the second one, I think, is in a way more interesting. And the legalities of also perhaps are very interesting, that basically one of Netanyahu's political enemies, Noni Moses, who owns Yediot Ahronot, which hitherto has been the most popular paper in Israel and been a gold mine. The gold mine is slowed down of late, and that's part of the story, was taped. I don't know how the calls were taped, whether it was wiretapping by the police.
They say now Ari Harrow,
okay,
a young man who's a BB assistant, he's right, been for many years. They say he made the tape, which is strange. Maybe, and apparently BB knew it was being taped.
Maybe they thought that they could each, would in the event of something, they could each, you know, have something on the other or be able to protect themselves against the other.
I'm getting an image of, I think, a cartoon from when I was a little kid of bad guys like stabbing each other in the back, sneaking around one another to stab one another in the back.
So apparently there are multiple conversations on tape in which basically they're discussing how, first, and we'll get to this, Yisrael Hayom is in a paper which is funded by Sheldon Adelson and Bibi, and which has posed a real economic threat besides an ideological powerhouse. A real economic threat to Yediot, because it's given out freely every day in Israel for a long time already. And so the deal was apparently that if they wouldn't put out a Mosaf Sof Shavua, you know, they have a weekend edition free, which would really hurt the sales of Yediot, then Noni Moses would call off the dogs. They would be much more friendly to Bibi in terms of their coverage. And apparently the deal eventually broke down in some way, but that was the deal. So I guess we could talk about the first case. Ben, you, I think, tweeted or put on Facebook that you, when you guess, you're usually wrong, but you don't think you think that in this case, the cigar will just be a cigar and that it won't lead to a criminal conviction.
My guesstimate, and like I said, my political guesses tend to be dead wrong. So I may be condemning Prime Minister Netanyahu in what I'm about to say. I'm guessing that he'll get an ethical violation, some sort of slap on the wrist by the Attorney General saying you shouldn't have done it, don't do it in the future, set up some sort of guidelines for receiving gifts, no more gifts more than $50, $100, something like that, once a year, and nothing more than that.
Okay, I don't know about the final result, but I don't think that it's going to remain with the Attorney General. I won't go as far as Haaretz, and basically, I think that they've made a very strong case that the current Attorney General, Mandelblit, has, and the former Attorney General, Weinstein, who, by the way, was Bibi's and Sarah's lawyer in a very similar incident in which they got to what's happening now with the three criminal charges against charges which are being recommended against Sarah and the household. But there was another incident, and who was their lawyer but Weinstein? But both of them have moved very, very slowly against Bibi. And so the fact that he allowed it to become an investigation and then publicized it says to me that there seems to be a strong legal case. Otherwise, he wouldn't have let it go forward or wouldn't have publicized it. He would have come out with these other cases and say, I've examined it. You know, it may look fishy, but there's not enough evidence to bring. It doesn't meet the criteria of the law. And so we're dropping it. And it wasn't a good thing for the prime minister to do. But since he didn't do that, I think, and I was looking at the hook, there's actually a hook matanot with Nifharei Tzibur, with public officials. And it talks about the fact that you can accept, that is generally asur, it's forbidden to accept gifts, but you can accept a gift that's not valuable in the sort of the normal course of friendship. But here, apparently, and the police have either through Milchin or some other evidence to the fact that Bibi made specific requests, that this wasn't a one-time deal, and that he was getting hundreds of thousands of shekels worth of merchandise over a long period of time. So you would say, I think, you know, also logically, I can therefore get away with bribing someone or just paying off a public official so they'll be in my good graces. I don't have to give them money. I'll just give them presents. I don't think, you know, the way the law is written that it allows that to happen. And his lawyer, I thought it was amusing. Anyone can go see the video for 1 minute, 1.5 minutes, said, Kol bar dat, everyone with an ounce of sechel knows that if you give someone a cigar, then that's okay. But it apparently was more than one cigar, and it was more than a few dollars. So I think he's in a lot of trouble on that one. That's just my opinion.
It's hard to know. You know, his Bibi's guys are on TV making cigar jokes, and what's the big deal, and a cigar, and come on, a little champagne, and what's the big deal? And the thing with Nuni Moses and the and Yediot, the deal never happened. So I'm not the lawyer in the room, so I don't know if you're taped having a conversation about maybe we'll do this. And even if it did happen, I don't know if it's illegal. Is it illegal to change an editorial, a newspaper's editorial position?
Okay, so I thought about it, and I didn't have time. There's a 700-page decision of the Beit Mishpat Elyon in the various Netanyahu appeals, and they discuss where I think one of the judges did find him guilty for accepting a hotel room from Talansky, and they also discuss
Olmert. You mean
Olmert? Olmert, right? Right. And they discuss what is hafarat imunim, what is a breach of trust. This first of all, let's just go back to the gifts. The gifts one could be a violation of the gift law, and it could also be a breach of trust. Don't forget, there's things that was Haaretz published that on four occasions, Netanyahu met or talked to John Kerry about getting a visa for Milchin. Milchin, for some reason, had visa problems getting into the United States. I don't know why, what the background is, but I'm saying those are the things. That's why you give people. Milchin was part of the ownership of Arutz Eser. So you want one of the samanim of hafarati imunim is to be in nigud inyanim, to be in a conflict of interest, take gifts from someone who who you may somehow interfere or have cause to be involved in their affairs. If I can get back now to the second case, which Rabbi Felix mentioned, it's very complex because Netanyahu, despite denying it, and Haaretz said, apparently he, you know, almost a regular basis is in touch with the editor of Yisrael Hayom and controls what's happening in the newspaper. So despite his denials. So he could just say, this is not my official capacity. I do not run Yisrael Hayom, right? Just like any politician. Politicians do favor for journalists all the time. There's quid pro quo.
And they can call up an editor and yell at him.
Yeah, he could say, look, you know, you want them to not do something, whatever, you know, we'll make some quid pro quo, some deal, but I'm making it qua politician. I'm not making it using my office, except that there's a few things here that need to be dealt with. The reason we've had an election, the reason we had the previous election was because there was a hook that was going to go through, backed by people like Lieberman, who was then Bekasaching Bibi, who wanted to basically outlaw Yisrael Hayom for very good reasons, which I'll get to in a moment. Maybe it shouldn't be outlawed. And the current prime minister is not now Sar HaTikshoret, Minister of Communications, but that, you know, this could have all taken place presumably before. But to say that when Noni Moses came to him, he wanted not a specific favor. He said, the competition is getting to me. They are hurting me economically, right? Without any justification. It wasn't as if someone was doing something that was nasty, illegal, and he said, please help. You know, these people are doing horrible things. It's like a businessman who's being hurt by lawful competition comes to a sitting prime minister and says, I want you to stop those guys. And the sitting prime minister is being backed by a billionaire in the United States who owns the same newspaper, Sheldon Adelson. And presumably Sheldon Adelson is a big patriot and he's doing all these things, but he has good relations with Bibi. And maybe now and then he wants a quid pro quo for you know, being such a nice guy and supporting him. So I tend to agree that I think this one, Weinrot, in his lawyer, said, look, no money changed hands, there was no loans, and this may be sort of like really bad morally, but it's on the gvul. He didn't even say it's on the gvul. Mandelblit did. So I think on this one, because you could argue he did not do what he did in a public capacity, he did it kind of like as a private individual, then it's not okay, but it isn't illegal. On the other hand, you could say, well, if he wasn't, no one but the prime minister would have the power to say to a newspaper, that still Yisrael Hayom, it's a powerful thing, and a powerful guy like Sheldon Adelson, look, I have this deal with Yediot, they want this, and they want you to stop that. Make this deal. Who else could do it? Who else could make that deal but the prime minister? And then his ties to Yisrael Hayom, if it's not illegal, he should resign on the spot. But that, I think, is...
Leon, as you speak, right. I'm feeling more and more that Ben is right.
Right.
And maybe even more than that, that I really am not sympathetic exactly. That's too strong a word. But this kind of stuff must go on all the time. I mean, I cannot imagine that Hillary Clinton's people don't talk to the people of the New York Times. It's just unimaginable. Or that Donald Trump's people don't talk to the trolls at Breitbart, or wherever the hell these cretins get their news from. But, you know, it almost feels natural. Like, of course, politicians talk to newspaper men and... I don't know. I just don't see the illegal thing. The thing, by the way, with the visa and Milchin.
Right.
Milchin apparently, I mean, it's very complicated and I didn't follow it in the past. He was involved with the nuclear reactor in Dimona. He had a lot to do with security.
Well, he admitted, they wrote a book about him in which he was helpful to the Israeli government in obtaining materials for the reactor in
right.
Dimona.
So it's a very old Israeli thing that guys who are like, wow, this guy is really has been helpful. If he then needs a visa to stay in America, that almost feels it's within the purview of what a politician should
well,
do.
Obviously,
is help him have a visa.
It wasn't such a simple case that he needed John Kerry to four times. There must have been some complication or some difficulty which made it, you know,
perhaps.
Like.
So what? So
what?
So what?
So what? So what?
I don't understand.
Politicians do exactly that. They push their countries businesses forward. They put on tariffs on imports because some rich guy.
I was once called.
All those things are.
Iraq, what he did with Mark Rich.
I don't understand. Well, sure. First of all, with
remember that case?
Yes, yes.
I remember the
criminal. Mark Rich was a criminal.
I remember the part. The Clinton partner.
One of our former rabbis.
Right.
Went to bat for Mark Rich.
Yes.
Right. Fine. They can go to bat.
Why did they do that? Not because they liked Mark Rich.
There was money involved.
Mark Rich read poetry to them, or because he has beautiful blue eyes. Because Mark Rich gave them money.
Yes.
I understand that, but as Senator Sam Ervin said in the Watergate hearings, for those of us who are old enough to remember the Watergate hearings, he said, you know, rape and murder have gone on all generations. That's true, but it doesn't legalize it. The question is, when you have, you know, Yisrael Yom, people say, what are you so upset, particularly on the right? They say it's freedom of speech. You know, why are you upset about the fact that there's this thing called Yisrael Hayom? So now I'll tell you why I'm upset and why this whole, even if it doesn't, this, I think the cigar and champagne parsha maybe seem to some people simple. Legally, I think it's going to be difficult to get out of that one. I think the more hamur one, which is the second one, this particular one. But what bothers me about Yisrael Hayom is you have a free newspaper, which if you open it up, nowhere does it say who it's owned by, who puts it out. You can look, take it, Yisrael Hayom, and look. Most newspapers have published by so-and-so. And even if they don't tell you who the actual owners are, they'll list the name of the company. And you can do a search. You can do a company search, or you can search on the internet. You can say it's owned by this family.
Well, you can certainly do a search and find out that Sheldon Adelson pays.
No, but they don't put it on the paper. They don't put it on the paper.
All right, okay.
No, it makes a difference.
Next.
It's not next. You take it out for free. And then you basically kill Israeli newspapers. Then we find out that yes, it is controlled by the prime minister, and the same prime minister who wants to basically take over the Tikshoret, who sets up for at a cost of $1.5 billion shekels a new broadcasting authority, and then says, "Hey, wait a minute, they may be fair-minded and objective. Let's try and counsel them." And then you have the same person who's prime minister, minister of Tikshoret, who wants to control the broadcasting networks, who controls the press. He's trying to control both sides of the press. On one hand, get fair coverage from this newspaper, and on the other hand, dampen the bad coverage from another newspaper. Doesn't that worry you guys? Or you're saying, like I said before, all politicians are bad, so there's nothing to worry about. It doesn't, as to the fabric of Israeli democracy, it doesn't bother you at any point what is going on in these particular instances?
Well, it certainly bothers me. Having said which, Israel's left will make sure that there will be an Haaretz. There will be the newspaper Haaretz, which is as dedicated to its left-wing agenda as Yisrael Hayom is dedicated to its right-wing pro-Bibi agenda, for better or for worse. In other words, although I do sense there's a kind of unfairness in this criminal, because he's a criminal, Adelson. I mean, he got the casinos open in Macau by murdering people, apparently. That's how you get the casino monopoly in Macau, by murdering people. You know, it's not a pleasant business. It's not a malacha nekiya running casinos. But be that as it may, it's not nice, and it certainly is unfair, giving away for free is an unfair kind of business practice. But on the other hand, there's a freedom of speech argument to be made. I don't know that there was a proper right-wing newspaper around before this happened, before Yisrael Hayom happened. And Haaretz's monopoly, which it still sort of has intellectually. I mean, Yisrael Hayom is not a serious newspaper. It's like it's modeled after after USA Today. It's not a serious newspaper. But I find it hard to find what's illegal about it. I agree with you. I am worried about Bibi's paranoia about the press and his willingness to really get down there and try to affect the press and silence it and not allow for a press that is argumentative and penetrative and you know willing to criticize him. It is not a good thing. I'm gonna skip right to the chase here. I think most Israelis, and that's why Bibi's still the prime minister, I don't see a white knight who's in the waiting in the wings Get rid of this BB and I'll take care of things. That's the problem. You know, this whole conversation, I actually agree. I think we all feel very bad about BB's attempt to manipulate the press, and Sheldon Adelson is a creep and his involvement here is certainly unwelcome, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the bribes are bribes and the money is money. It's all true. But at the end of the day, I think that many of us feel, I don't know, Bougie Herzog? Really? Yair Lapid, that childish clown? Really? Who's going to run the country? Not that I think Bibi's doing a good job. Really, I don't. And maybe I've drunk the Kool-Aid. Maybe I don't know. I don't know what it is, but I can't get that worked up about it, because then I have to ask myself the next question. So who's going to take over if we get rid of Bibi? And I don't see an answer.
I just wanted to reply to the thing about, I don't have any problems with Yisrael Ayom. My problem is that, A, any newspaper that's been given out should on its face, you talked about soldiers like Elor Azaria may not be the brightest guy on the planet. Well, when a soldier gets that newspaper, the Tachana Merkazit, he, Letumo, thinks that this is like the news. Like, you know, he doesn't know what's, He doesn't compare.
It's not more right wing than Haaretz is left wing.
You're misunderstanding me. I couldn't care. Let there be 20 million right wing newspapers or media in Israel. I'm not afraid of debate or whatever. What I find slightly insidious is here you have a newspaper that, you know, if you look at it, doesn't tell you where it's from.
Granted.
That's being completely funded free by someone who lives in Chutz La'aretz, and it's completely political. I mean, its agenda is, there's no other agenda but to serve the occupant of the prime minister's office. And I find that collusion, which Haaretz has been talking about, and which Bibi has denied, that's pretty scary. I find that in a democracy, that's scary.
I don't really disagree. I don't really disagree. Okay, but I think Haaretz is partially owned. Isn't Axel Springer? Isn't there German ownership of Haaretz?
Could be. Because that's,
maybe I'm mixed up. I'm not sure.
That as a percentage, they're not doing so well. I mean, financially, despite, I don't know if they'll be around forever and ever. As to who will take over, I think that there are some decent people in Israeli politics. I don't like Yair Lapid. See, at least I find, you know, I wouldn't vote for him in a million years, despite the fact that he is, you know, maybe not as right, or he's not in the right-wing party compared to Bibi. I wouldn't vote for Herzog because I think he's a weak leader, and I don't think bad person, but he doesn't have any charisma. He's not a successful politician. But I don't think it's as important as we think. We always want to think that these leaders or people who lead us are superior. We need someone to look up to. And in the end, there are many good people in the system. But what we have to do is protect the system. Because if we don't protect the system, it doesn't matter who the leader is going to be. And the leader will be, it's like in the Haredi Tzibur. The myth is that they would like to believe that Siyata Deshmaya, they have these great leaders, right? But they don't talk about the fact that, you know, they have internecine fights between themselves, and really the people underneath, to a large degree, determine who the Gadol Hador is going to be. So in the same way, it's the same kind of thing here. The system is more important. In the end, the system is going to choose leaders. If Bibi steps out of at least the parsha of the Matanot, and Mendelblit covers up all the other parshas and against Sarah and dismisses this and dismisses that, and he walks out free of, you know, scot-free, then the system goes down. And every time it goes down more, it won't matter in the end who the person in charge will be, because we'll have ceased to be in certain ways fully democratic or non-corrupt society, and then it doesn't matter. So I'm a system person. I'm less a, like, you know, people used to talk about Ronald Reagan, and he was a great leader, and it didn't matter that he wasn't the brightest guy on the planet. But Lamafreya, it turned out that it mattered, right? And George W. Bush, because in the end, you know, these people have to make decisions and stuff like that. So, but in the end, I'm saying the system is much more important than the leader. And if we don't protect the system, I think we're in trouble. Ben?
I'll just add one quick note. My European friends have told me, there's quite an echo here, that Americans are quite naive about newspapers. European newspapers are extremely politicized. Yes. They don't hide it. They don't hide who they like. They don't hide who they hate. They don't pretend to this idea of objectivity. They take sides, and that's the way it is. And Israeli newspapers are based on that model, because that's where Israel came from. It came from Europe. It didn't come from the U.S. with its ideas of fair play and all that stuff. So we just have to get on this bandwagon, take a side, and fight it out.
Yeah, but I think that, you know, I always, what you said is completely true. I remember growing up in Canada and, you know, starting to read or European newspapers and while in Canada. And then it occurred to me exactly what you said. You know, in France, they have Le Monde, they have a conservative newspaper, they have Le Figaro. Everyone knows what the ideology is of the newspaper. The same thing in Germany. And fair enough. But America had this concept, as did England to a certain degree. You know, there was the New York Times, and the New York Times was called the paper of record for a reason. Because in the New York Times, you, even though you they had an editorial slant, and every couple of years they said, we want so-and-so for president, we don't want so-and-so for president, and they had editorials, you could count on it for the news. And similarly, I like to read Haaretz because it's a paper that has investigative reporting, and it has news, and it's been reporting these scandals now for the longest time. You know, the current scandals for like 6 months, and they've been saying something's going to come out and something's going to come out, and they couldn't, they were putting their act together, or they couldn't say it publicly. So I think we're really going down the rabbit hole. We're really in danger if we say to ourselves that a newspaper that purports to be a newspaper doesn't anymore have to adhere to facts, doesn't have to prevent facts, doesn't have to do true investigative reporting that a reporter can back up his story with facts. Then we're screwed. We're in the post-truth age, the alternate truth age. And I don't think that's a good place to be. I mean, look what's happened to the United States. So you can attack the New York Times, but if you still want to know what's going on in the world, you know, what actually happened, you read the New York Times, you use your filter if you think that, you know, they're coming at it, but at least you get some facts. At least they feel that they have to be accountable.
I honestly read both. I read the Times online, and when I walk by a guy giving out Yisrael Hayom, I take it. It's not such a horrible paper. It's simplistic. It's superficial. They throw in a Yossi Beilin. He's a columnist once or twice a week. I don't know, but he's in there once in a while. They have some awful. They were pro-Trump. They're, you know, awful stuff. But Haaretz, I also find very off-putting in their fealty to what is often a very far left-wing and often a very supercilious, arrogant, Tel Aviv-y kind of approach to things that on a cultural level I find offensive. Forget the politics. Culturally, I find Haaretz offensive. So they both, you know, they're no good. And the, you know, we talked earlier about the plight of the political culture. Journalism is in very big trouble. I don't think anybody knows how to present facts. I watch CNN and I watch Sky and I watch MSNBC and I watch and I watch and I watch. And sometimes there are, you know, moments, but there's a lot of stupidity and a lot of superficiality. And they don't know. They didn't know how to handle a Trump. They didn't know what to. They still don't know what to do with Trump. So I don't know. I don't know if it's their fault. Maybe the information age and the internet and sort of everything is out there and everything goes and nobody knows what's right and wrong, what's true or false. It's an interesting question, and maybe we'll talk about it one time. It's not that I disagree. I don't disagree with the points you've made. I'm just thinking that, as Ben said, like, you know, the fact that everybody does it is, you know, never an excuse. It wasn't an excuse back in grade school, you know, but everybody was talking, you know. It didn't work then. Having said which, it does, context is everything. And if what Bibi is doing is contextually not really that different from what the average politician does, so, which I think it sort of is. I in a better world, of course. In a better world, we get rid of him, and in a better world, we wouldn't have him. But right now, we do. I don't know what the solution is exactly, and I'm not sure that the courts or the police are the way out of a Netanyahu, the Netanyahu dead end we're in now.
Okay, another spirited discussion. We're going to wait and see what happens with the investigation, but by then. Since we live in interesting times, I'm sure something new will be on the horizon. Thank you, everyone. Hope to hear from you shortly. Bye.
Bye-bye. There's something else I wanted to say. Oh, I forgot.
I talked way too much.
You talked a little.